So I was talking to a minister, long-time minister. We just happened to hit, just talk about something about in Revelation chapter 17 or something. We talked about the great whore, and he said, "Oh yes, the church, that refers to a church." I said, "No, it doesn't. Take a look at what it says. It doesn't refer to a church." I said, "Read the very last verse. The woman, it defines who the woman is. The woman whom you saw is the great city, which reigns over the kings of the earth." Look at that in Revelation 17, verse 18. The woman that you saw, what is that woman? The great city. Now let me ask you a question. Were you surprised that the two witnesses who are witnessing, and when they are killed, where are they? What city are they killed in? Well, if you read Revelation chapter 11, and it talks about the dead bodies in verse 8, their dead bodies will lie in the streets of what? The great city, which mystically is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord, meaning Jesus Christ, the two witnesses have a Lord there, and Lord is Jesus Christ. Their Lord was crucified. What city was that? And why are the two witnesses who are testifying before this beast power, and the beast power comes up and kills them? And where does he kill them? He kills them in Jerusalem. He kills him in that street, and their bodies lie down. They just lie in the street where they were killed. In what city? The great city where our Lord was crucified. And then in chapter 17, you talk about a whore called Babylon, Mystery Babylon, the great mystery. It's not the real Babylon. It's the mystery, the mystical, the mystique. The mystery Babylon, not the real Babylon, just like it's a mystery Sodom, the mystery Egypt, and they were called names. What did God call Jerusalem after she went away and she started being part of all the other nations? What did he call her? He called her a harlot, a whore. It's a terrible name here in Revelation 17. It's an ugly name, but he called her this whore, this harlot, because she was going away from God. She was supposed to be married to God, and she's giving herself to all these other nations instead of giving herself to God. So here, this city, it becomes the capital city of the world at that time. Because where does this woman look at it? The woman which you saw, verse 18 of chapter 17 of Revelation, is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. And she's called Babylon. And she's going to come down. God is going to bring her down like all the other, things. She's going to come down before the end because she has left God. And there was the center of all the religious powers, the center of all the religious powers of the world. And if the Arabs and the Jews ever actually can find a way to live in peace, you're going to find that they will form a power that challenges every other group of nations on the earth. They will probably be a huge power, and all the stuff will emanate from them. That's probably somewhere in the future beyond my lifetime and beyond yours. I was just shocked because evidently he and the church he belonged to, they're stuck in the same thing. Oh, a woman means a church, because of Ephesians. Therefore, I said, well, it's defined. It's defined. It doesn't say church. It says city. And then, of course, people, the other people who wanted to be Rome, oh, well, that's Rome, the Rome city. Therefore, it has to be the Catholic Church, and therefore, it had to be this. But the city, the great city, the same city in which. Why were the two witnesses killed in Jerusalem? I mean, if Jerusalem is an off place and Rome is the center of everything, well, why were they killed in Jerusalem? They're killed where the capital, where the beast sits, where the beast is in power. And that's the same place that the city is, called the whore. That's Jerusalem. Anyhow, I would just want to, as an aside, I was stunned because I have known this for over 40-some years, and I'm shocked that a lot of people don't know it. So if you're listening to this sermon and these Sabbath services, you're getting a lot more information than most of the ministers that you have known. You know probably more about it than the ministers you have known, and more about the Bible than the ministers you have known. We'll pick it up now where we were last time, because this is very deep, and chapter 7 of the Daniel. And I want to go back to verse 8. Verse 7. This dreadful, terrible. Okay, we have these words. Now, in the Hebrew, it's actually not Hebrew, it's Aramaic. The Aramaic word dreadful is also used in other places, just so you know. It's used for the image of King Nebuchadnezzar's image in chapter 2 and verse 31. It's translated awesome. He had this awesome image that was there, and it's translated dreadful in verse 7, Daniel 7, verse 7, where it's talking about that fourth beast. So you see it describes Daniel's fears in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 5, dreadful, and the people fear, chapter 5 and verse 19. It's the same word, okay, same Aramaic word. Now you have another word used, it's called devour. You see it over here? It devoured and crushed and trampled down. Devour. It devoured. That's also used literally in chapter 4 where Nebuchadnezzar devoured grass. He ate the grass. He devoured it. He devoured the grass. And then you'll see it. It's used about the fourth beast here in chapter 7, verse 5, verse 7, verse 19. All are used the same word. And then it's used metaphorically for slander when in chapter 6 and verse 25, and in chapter 2, in verse 8, when the people came and they brought something against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they used the word is devour. The king moved to devour them, to slander them, to devour them. Okay, that's the same. And the word crushed, you'll see it in verse here, he crushed and trampled down in verse 7. Crushed and broken pieces. It's used in Daniel 7, verse 7, and verse 19, and verse 23 of the fourth beast. It's also used literally of the Messiah in the image in chapter 2, verse 35 and verse 45, where this stone came without hands, and it came, and what did it do? It crushed the beast. It crushed that fourth beast on its feet and broke all the feet, toes and the iron and the clay, and they all just crushed it, and the whole thing came cascading down. That the same Greek word, I mean, same Hebrew, Aramaic word is used. Okay, so you see it used literally of crushed. And it's also used literally when the lions came in, you remember, and crushed those who had attacked Daniel, their families, and so on. It crushed them. Same word. It's used here in, just to show you the various ways in which this same word is used. Now, of course, the ten horns. Okay, you see the ten horns here? Ten horns. This beast had ten horns. Okay, he saw this the beast terrifyingly. It had the beast, and there were ten horns on this beast. These ten horns seemed to be kings that were reigning simultaneously. And how do we know that? Because we know in chapter 7 and verse 8, okay, three of them were taken out at the same time. And I was contemplating, I'm going to read verse 8 of chapter 7 here. Verse 8, I was contemplating, he says, And behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the root before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. They had to be simultaneous because all three of them were pulled out at the same time by the little horn, because of that little horn. Okay, so there's something here. These ten may be a symbol of completeness. We don't know exactly why. But here you see in Zechariah chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, Zechariah 1. So I said to the angel who was speaking to me, "What are these?" And he answered me, "These are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem." Then the Eternal showed me four craftsmen. I said, "What are these coming to do?" He said, "These are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man lifts up his head, but these craftsmen have come to terrify them, to throw them down, to throw down the horns of the nations who have lifted up their horns against the land of Judah in order to scatter it." So the horns are kings. The horns are powers. They're some form of power, and usually they're defined here in the book of Daniel as kings. You see it in Revelation chapter 13, verse 1. "And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw the beast coming out of the sea, having the ten horns. And he had seven heads. And on his horns were diadems. And on the heads were blasphemous names." Now, diadems, I'm reading from getting this from the Nelson's Illustrated Bible Dictionary. A diadem is a band wrapping around the turban of a king or his queen, signifying their royal authority. That's what a diadem is. Now, rulers of the ancient Near East, did not wear rigid gold crowns, but cloth turbans wound around the head and decorated in turn with cloth diadems studded with gems. They would have this cloth diadem, and it was studded with gems. It wrapped around the things. In this case, they are wrapping around the horns. So two Hebrew words are translated as diadem in the Old Testament. One comes from a word meaning to wind around, and the other comes from a word that refers to the high priest. Now, in Leviticus chapter 8, verse 9, it refers to the high priest's turban, okay, as well as to the king's turban. You'll see it in Ezekiel chapter 21, verse 26. So just an aside, the word also is rendered diadem in several Old Testament passages, such as Isaiah 62 and verse 3, and Job 29 and verse 14. Now, in the New Testament uses the Greek word for diadem only in the book of Revelation. It's not used in any of the other places, only in Revelation. The New Testament makes a clear distinction between diadems and crowns. A crown was a garland of sorts, of a wreath, a kind of a wreath that you put on as a person who won in a race or was a reward for faithful service, such as the crown of righteousness Paul referred to in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8. I will get a crown of righteousness, he said, which the Lord will give me, and not only to me, but all those who love his appearing, he says. So a crown is a reward. It's putting on it like a wreath, like signifying a winner. You're the winner. While a diadem is always a symbol of royal authority. It's, you know, you put that around. So this beast had ten horns and in the book of Revelation, the horns had diadems on them. So the horns, of course, generally stand for kings. You see that in chapter 7 and chapter 8 of Daniel. And it's a metaphor for power. So in chapter 7 and verse 8, we see this another horn, a little one coming up from among them. and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And the little horn of Daniel 7 may be the Antichrist of that of the end time, because it comes up in the fourth kingdom. You see here? This is the fourth kingdom. That little horn could represent the Antichrist of the last time. But this is a little bit, there's just a little bit of confusion here when you read Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. Let's go to Daniel 8, and you're going to see this horn come up in chapter 8 and verse 9. Look what you see in verse 8. The male goat magnified himself exceedingly. And what's the male goat? It's called Greece. It's Grisha. But as soon as he was mighty, a large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. And most people interpret that as the power of Greece. And after Alexander the Great died, it's separated into four different, you know, the four different empires, the four different groups. His four generals took it over. But look at verse 9. Out of one of those horns, out of the four there, out of one of those horns came a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. The beautiful land is God's name here for Israel. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them. So now here's a little horn, but this comes up from Greece, not the fourth beast, but another little horn. But listen to what this little horn does. Virtually every little horn does the same thing. It magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. The commander of the host is either the angel of the Lord or God himself. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of the transgression of the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling the truth to the ground and perform its will, and it will prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to these like angels, said to the particular one who was speaking, he said, how long will the vision of the regular sacrifice apply? While the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled, how long will it be? And then, of course, the answer in verse 14 is 2,300 evenings and mornings. That means 1,100 days. Then that's evening and morning sacrifices, you know, the afternoon, morning, evening and morning. So that's 1,100 days, 1,150 days, and the holy place will be properly restored. So this horn looks like it comes out of one of the horns of the four that are coming out of the kingdom of Greece. So there's a little bit of confusion here, just a little bit. But we know that this other horn is the one, the little horn, you know, these little horns are arrogant, all of them arrogant and boastful. They reject the worship of the eternal God, Yahweh or Yehovah, and try to destroy his people. They are both allowed by God to prosper, and both will in the end be destroyed by God. They seem to symbolize the Antichrist. When does the Antichrist appear? It appears regularly, often. Anybody that's opposed to the worship of the true and eternal God becomes what? It becomes the Antichrist. They're anti-Messiah. They don't want God's rule. They don't want God's Messiah to be ruling over the earth. These little horns are often arrogant. The little horn of Daniel 7 may be the very Antichrist of the end time right before, and the one that we see in the book of Revelation. This seems to be, the one in chapter 8 seems to refer to Antiochus Epiphanes, who reigned between 175 and 164 B.C. His reign was there. He was terrifying, just Oh, let me read. Look at this. He comes in that third kingdom of the Maccabean era, period, the Maccabean period where the Maccabees, the brothers, try to fight against being taken over by Greece and where they're trying to wipe out the worship of God and trying to establish the pagan worship. Antiochus Epiphanes was said to have even gone into the temple and thrown and sacrificed pigs and thrown swine's fat and the fat of swines around just to show the Jews how much he despised their religion and all the Old Testament stuff. He forced people into it. Many people gave into it, but the Maccabees wouldn't. They fought and they fought and they fought and they finally won. Here's 1 John chapter 2, verse, children, it is the last hour. And just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have appeared. Yeah, from this we know that it is the final hour. The Antichrists are coming, and there will be one at the end of the ages, and the end of this age. So these little horns are often boastful, arrogant. All right, so in chapter 7, verses 9 and 10 and 12 and 13 and 14, just so you know, and if you have a New American Standard Version, you will see verse 9. These are beautiful verses. These are beautiful verses, okay. I kept looking until the thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days appeared. This is, you'll see this. These are in Hebrew poetry. They are done in parallelism. You have to understand the parallelism of the Hebrew poetry, okay? I kept looking, and that's not part of the poem. But then, until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Now, unfortunately, the King James Version, I don't know what they... I guess in ancient English, King James Version says thrones were cast down. Now, in modern English, that would mean the thrones were destroyed. They were not. Thrones were being set up. Okay, all these thrones are being set up. And the Ancient of Days takes his seat. So the thrones are around. Now, here's the poem. Until the thrones were set up, that's one line, and the Ancient of Days takes his seat. That's a parallelism. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. So that's, again, parallelism. His vesture was like white snow. His hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. That's one line. Its wheels were burning, were a burning fire. And that's the other line. And then verse 10, a river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Then you have thousands upon thousands were attending him. And myriads, that's tens of thousands, upon tens of thousands were standing before him. Tens of thousands upon tens of thousands, times tens of thousands, were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. So the court sat, that's one line, and the books were opened. So here you have, in heaven, with the Ancient of Days, sitting here on this court, and all these other thrones, see, the thrones, not one throne, not just for the Ancient of Days, but for the others. Now, the New International says thousands upon thousands attending him, and 10,000 times 10,000s stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were open. So you begin in verse chapter 7 and verse 9. All this evil suffering and so on is contrasted. You see, up here, he's scared of these beasts. He's scared of this. This one is so dreadful. And all the way to verse 8, and this eyes and these things boasting. But all of a sudden, you have this very peaceful, this section, the very peaceful thing of God's throne. And it's contrasted, you see. with God in heaven and the peace that is there. So the section of this section of chapter 7 and the parallelism is sort of like the way that you have the crushing stone of chapter 2 that initiates the eternal kingdom. So here you have here, you're scared of these beasts, and this fourth beast is dreadful and terrible and crushing and all this stuff. And then these horns come up, and this little horn boasting, saying utterly, uttering great things. But all of a sudden, you get a picture of God's heaven. And God is in charge, and God is going to be judging. God is judging everything. So God's judicial acts result in, what do they result? Redemption, reconciliation, and lasting fellowship between God himself and his faithful angels and his faithful saints, his human saints. So the purpose of this original is to restore God's merciful character and his redemptive intervention. Here you have God is now sitting on the throne here. Now, one of the greatest passages, as we read here, are verses 13 and 14. But let's read verse 11. Then I kept looking, because the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking, I kept looking until the beast was slain. See, God is in charge. The beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away. But an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. Just, God is in charge. God is going to extend their life for a little bit, for one, as much as he wants. And in chapter 7 here, in verse 13, a beautiful messianic passage. I kept looking. Now, this is also parallel. This is also in Hebrew poetry parallelism. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming, and he came to the Ancient of Days. And was presented before him, and to him was given dominion. To him, this one like the Son of Man. And this is where we get this word Son of Man. All the Jews began to think, well, who is this Son of Man? What is this Son of Man? You'll see this Son of Man used over, and this mysterious power, this being who's going to take it. What did Jesus call himself? The Son of Man. The Son of Man. He called himself this over and over and over again. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and every people of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. If we've heard that once in the book of Daniel, we've heard it over and over and over. You see, an everlasting eternity. You see it in chapter 2, verse 44. You see it in chapter 4, and verse 3, and verse 34. You see it in chapter 6, and verse 26. You see it here in verse 14, and again in verse 27. Then the sovereignty of the dominions of the greatness of the kingdom and of the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Over and over, his kingdom is everlasting. Why is his kingdom everlasting? Because he is everlasting. That's his name. The eternal, the everlasting one. His kingdom is everlasting because he's everlasting. You know one of the troubles in today's world? You could have a great ruler, and you see it in the annals of the kings of Israel. You had a great king. He comes on the scene. He's wonderful. He's good. He brings prosperity. He brings peace. He brings the righteousness of God. Hezekiah was one of them. Josiah was one of them. David was one of them. And so, but what happens? He dies. People die. They don't live forever. If you have a good leader of a country, you know, there have been good leaders. Not perfect leaders, but there have been some good leaders of countries. And They brought their countries to a certain amount of prosperity and peace and everything. And then they die. And then somebody else comes up. And what happens to the country? Well, it goes this way. You see it over and over again through the kings of Israel. One good king comes and he dies. And he's replaced. And often replaced by a very mediocre or a bad king who returns to the worship of Baal and worship of all these pagan things. The trouble with human kingdoms is they are not everlasting because the king is not everlasting. What's going to happen to God's kingdom? The king is everlasting. So the kingdom will be what? Everlasting. If we've seen it once, we've seen it over and over again. The persecution and the suffering of God's people will finally lead to victory. Because God will settle it. God will set up his kingdom in verse 27 of chapter 7 of Daniel. And it will be given to the people of the saints of the highest. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom. God's people here in these passages and in the book of Revelation, you're talking about suffering. There is no victory without suffering. Jesus was the suffering servant. If you read Isaiah 53, he took on our sins. If you read Psalm 22, oh my, it's, my God, why have you forsaken me? I'm down. And this is David's psalm, but part of it was applied to Christ himself. Romans chapter 8, verse 17. Now, if we are children, then we are heirs. Heirs of God. And co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share his sufferings in order that we may also share in his glory. There is no victory without suffering. Philippians chapter 3, verse 10, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection. And the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings. This is Philippians 3, verse 10. Becoming like him in his death. And so somehow to attain to the resurrection of the dead. That's from the New International Version, Philippians 3, and verse 10. Now, does everybody have to be crucified? Not necessarily. But many of us have gone through our suffering, whether silent, we ever told anybody, or not. We have physical pains, we have physical issues, we have physical problems, and we may not have said anything about it. We have suffered in our own way. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11 through 13, it is a trustworthy statement. For if we died with him, we shall also live with him. If we endure, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us. If we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. That's who he is. He's the faithful witness. And in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3, but to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing. So that also at the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exaltation, that it's glorious. And then, we know that evil and pain and suffering comes to us, but God often transforms that. He takes that evil and suffering that you have, that I have, and what's he do with it? He transforms it into something for spiritual growth and development. Listen to what it said about Jesus in Hebrews 5, verse 8. I won't read the whole thing, but doesn't it say something like this? Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. You and I learn with the things we suffered. Now, when we come back to this, we're coming back here now for a second to the thrones here. Let's take a look at the thrones of this. several theories. Who is it that sits on these thrones? One theory is that the angels sit on these thrones. You know, it talks about these thrones, myriads upon myriads of people, and so on. Are they angels? Yeah, they could be angels. You see in Psalm 89 and verse 7 and 8, it says, "A God greatly feared in the council of the holy ones." That could be saints. "And awesome above all those who are around him." People around God up in heaven would be angels. And "Oh, Lord God of hosts, O eternal, O Yahweh, God of hosts, who is like you, O mighty eternal? Your faithfulness also surrounds you." Are they angels up there? Are they sitting on some of these stones? There have been several theories. People saying, well, who's stone? Or is it the saints? And verse Daniel chapter 7, verse 22, "Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time will arrive when the saints will possess the kingdom." They will possess it. But Jesus said very specifically, didn't he? Jesus talking about thrones, specifically Matthew chapter 19, verse 28. "And Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you that you who have followed me in the regeneration when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." So these saints, these 12, these are just the 12, they're going to sit on 12 thrones. Luke chapter 22 and verse 30. "That you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom," he said, "and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." He's saying this to his own disciples, the 12. But listen to what 1 Corinthians chapter 6 says. He broadens it out here. The Apostle Paul broadens this thing way out. What do you think you're going to be? What do you think you're going to do? 1 Corinthians chapter 6. "Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is judged by you, are you not competent to constitute the smallest law courts? Can't you judge there in your own church?" He's telling the Corinthians, aren't you incompetent for that? And don't forget Revelation chapter 20 and verse 4. "Then I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who were beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark on their forehead or on their hand, and they came to life and reigned. They reigned with authority and thrones 1,000 years. And it also might refer to the 24 elders, you know, up in heaven that they surround God's throne. Maybe refer to those beings rather than just an ordinary angel, other angelic beings. I want to point out to you a thing in the verse 9. Verse 9 of my Bible, and most Bibles, uses the word, "and the Ancient of Days." Actually, there's no definite article of this statement in of an Aramaic title. It just says, "an Ancient of Days," okay, "and an Ancient of Days" set here. In other words, it's emphasizing the timelessness of that person, that one. "And an Ancient of Days sat here." This is how the Common English Bible version says, "one who has been living forever." The other one says, "the eternal God." Another one says, "one like a very old man." That's the Bible in basic English. And in the English Revised Version, it says, "and one that was Ancient of Days did sit." In other words, it doesn't have the word there, the ancient. It just says an old person, a person who had been Ancient of Days, had living a long, long time. But in verse 13, okay, let's drop down to verse 13. I kept looking in the night visions. So in verse 9, there is not a definite article. But verse 13, there is. And I kept looking in the night visions, and one like the Son of Man came to whom? The. And now the definite article is here in verse 13. The Ancient of Days. That title is a characterization of God as the living God. You'll see it in Daniel 4 and verse 34, chapter 6 and verse 26, chapter 12 and verse 7. The living God, as opposed to the dead gods. This is the God who is alive, who will never die, who is always going to be there. The living God, the God who lives forever. It's the covenant God for Israel, and thank God he lives forever, or Israel would have been extinguished. But he's the living God, and he's our living God, and we're going to live with him in that kingdom. And the definite article is here in verse 13 and also in verse 22. And it says here in verse 20, he kept looking until that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints. So here's God, the ever-living one, going to, the Ancient of Days came, and he's going to rescue the saints. He's going to put down this power of this little horn who is persecuting his people. He's going to put it down. He may let his people suffer a little bit, but he's going to be. Now, you see in chapter 7 in verse 9, it talks about his vesture, it says the Ancient of Days took his seat, his vesture was like white snow, and his hair was like pure wool. White snow often refers to heavenly beings and to purity. You know, God is like in white. He's all white. Jesus, when he appeared with, he said, you will see the kingdom of God. None of you will die before you see the kingdom of God. And he had that transfiguration, you remember? But in Revelation 1, you see Jesus looks like white snow. His face shines like the sun. His hair and his head is white as wool. And then angels often appear as white, as like in Daniel chapter 10 and verses 5 and 6. And in the New Testament, you see here that they do that when Jesus was, he was bright, he was like white. Luke chapter 24 and verse 4, John 20 and verse 12. Acts 1 and verse 10, and then the saints have to be dressed in white. In Revelation, we have the saints who are dressed in white. White is a characteristic of pureness, cleanliness, and a characteristic of God, angels, and heavenly beings, and the saints. So you understand some of these things. So the hair and the head was wool. That refers to the ancient, the aged. It's all white hair. What does white stand for when you're older and you get white hair? But white and pure of these two, you know, these two lines of poetry speak both of wisdom and holiness. Okay, the judgment of God was given, and God has the authority, the right and the authority to sit on that white throne. There's a white throne in Revelation 20 and verse 11. So you have these poetic lines speak also of fire. You know, he speaks of fire. A river of fire was flowing through it, you see. Its wheels were like burning fire. This is has to do very much like Ezekiel. Ezekiel's thing in Ezekiel 1, the chariot of wheels. And so you have the chariot here, but it's chariot of fire. Fire has to do with the metaphor of holiness and cleansing. Fire, we are cleansed by fire. Don't be upset by the fiery trial. Fiery trial is a cleansing. You know, if you want to purify something, you put it under fire and burns all the bad things away from gold. And how you purify gold is to heat it up, and you get the gold apart from the other metals. It'll usually melts first. And so you purify gold. You purify us. We are going to be tried with fire, but that's okay, because we're going to inherit something ourselves. And that is going to be a great day when we come before God, before his throne, Because our names are written where? In God's book of life. I'll talk about that next time. God has two books. You'll be surprised. We'll talk about it next time.